first RAJAR results came out, it was a disaster. A spliff, a shag, or a campaign on Galaxy 101. Rotten Earth, would you want to come and work for a radio station for?
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Don Thompson.
I was born in Oxford. I was the fifth of six children. Had a very, very religious upbringing. Whilst my dad was an engineer by profession and worked in the car industry in Oxford all of his working life, he was an elder of the local church, a sect called the Christian Brethren. All six children were faithfully at church on a Sunday, three times on a Sunday for a large part of my childhood, which gradually got more and more irritating the older I got. But it was a lovely family upbringing in many ways. Being fifth in line, it was got told what to do an awful lot. Well, at school, I started off okay. I went up to East Oxford County Primary and was there to the age of 11 and passed my 11 plus and went off to grammar school, which is Oxford Grammar School. As I got a little bit older, I got less and less interested in academic side of school and more interested in sport, but also more interested in pursuits outside of school. I took my O-levels, I took 9 O-levels, but I didn't do a stroke of work because I just was not interested. I couldn't wait to leave. And in those days, after you've taken your exams, you had to go back to the school in August to pick up the results. And I remember to this day going back to see Mr. Pryor, who was the headmaster, at the appointed time, knocked on his door and come in, went in, and Mr. Pryor said, Thompson, handing me an envelope. And he said, you weren't thinking of coming back, were you? And I opened the envelope, and in there was my prize 1 O-level.
Countryside in June, a programme illustrating with sounds and voices the varied nature of the British countryside. The programme is introduced by C. Gordon Glover.
In the 60s, my parents at home would have a radio. There would be two or three radios in the house, and they would be listening to either the Home Service or the Light programme. Whereas if I had a radio in my bedroom, I'd be listening to the pirate stations, Caroline or Radio London, but also Luxembourg in the evenings, thoroughly enjoyed. But my parents, being of the religious persuasion they were, they just frowned upon all this pop music. This was the swinging 60s. You know, they just hated all of that kind of stuff. We were not encouraged to be involved in it at all. But so on a Sunday afternoon, when Pick of the Pops was on, we certainly weren't allowed to listen to it in the house, I would nip out the back door and go to where my dad's car was parked in the next street and sit in the car and listen to Pick of the Pops on my own, which was Alan Freeman in those days.
We've got a twist here and there, also some of the Song for Europe melodies, all included in Unit 1, the newcomers to the top 20, Unit 2, the new releases, Unit 3, the Pick of the Pops LP spot.
I didn't know what I was going to do when I left school, but I just wanted to leave school. And the guy that owned the newsagent shop where I did my paper rounds, etc., was a distribution rep for the Daily Express. That was his full-time job. He said to me one day, he said, what are you going to do when you leave school? And I said, I've no idea. And he said, well, do you want to come and work in the shop? Because I want to expand. I'm going to leave my full-time job, but I want to buy another shop. So I literally left school on the Friday and started work the following day in the shop. And very quickly, within the space of a few weeks, he had bought another one. And I was ended up largely running this shop at the age of 16 or 17. A very, very busy newsagent on the Cowley Road in Oxford. So I would turn up and open the shop up at 5:30 in the morning, take in all the customers. There would be hundreds of them coming in on their way up to the car factory. So very quickly I learnt how to deal with customers, how to work on mental arithmetic, adding up the price of 20 senior service, a Daily Express, a packet of crisps and a bar of chocolate. But the thing that I really started to get to know fairly quickly was sales reps would be coming in during the course of the day to see the boss. It might be someone from Cadbury's or from Browntree's or from the greeting cards companies or whatever. And I was quite impressed by the fact that these guys always turned up in very nice suits and they drove nice shiny cars. And I thought, that must be quite nice being out and about.
Or mash, get smash.
I was particularly interested in products that had a good profile, etc., and were being advertised. And from the few TV ads that I did start to see when my parents did eventually get a television, I was always attracted by great brands. I remember clearly two or three ones that sort of stick in my memory even now, and they're classic ads anyway, I guess. Cadbury's Smash, Home Pride, Grated Grains Make Finer Flour. And another one, they're all food brands, Wonderloaf. They're a very well-known bread brand who had this wonderful catchphrase, "Nice one, Cyril." It was actually turned into a pop song, and then it was a football chant at Tottenham Hotspur a few years later as well. But I was fascinated by how these things were actually created and how these things just get woven into the culture. So I started buying the Grocer magazine every week and going through that looking for jobs, and applied to join Kellogg's. Probably one of the best breaks I ever had was landing a job with them. I was so chuffed when I got that. Started with them, I think this was in about 1977. We did a 6 weeks field training course, so out with a different sales rep every week for the first 6 weeks, and then ongoing training over the first 6 months. But when you got to the end of your 6 months, you spent 3 days out with your regional sales director. You wouldn't have a moment's peace, quite frankly, and he would assess every single call that you made. Anyway, one of the calls that we actually made was to Sainsbury's in Putney, and we were walking around the store doing the usual thing that we did, making sure that all the products they were due to be stocking were indeed out on the shelves. And one of the things that Kellogg's had always were very good at was arranging how the cereal fixtures were actually laid out. Sainsbury's wouldn't allow you to do that, but lots of other companies did. Anyway, we were standing there checking off the stock take, etc. And all of a sudden, there's three guys came up to us, and one of them said to me, "Could you tell me what you're doing?" In a rather disgruntled kind of a way. And I just turned to him and said, "Well, yes, we're just checking on the stocks." And anyway, the other two guys were taking an interest as well. And I started to explain to them what they were actually doing wrong. I assumed these other two guys were merchandise people. And I explained to them that if they actually rearranged their cereal fixture, they could actually sell an awful lot more cereal. And they needed to put more facings out for Kellogg's cornflakes, and they needed to do this, that, and the other. All the things that I had been taught over the previous 6 months. And we had quite a long conversation. It must have gone on for 10, 12 minutes or so. And they took great interest in what I had to say. So we left the store. I came out thinking, "Oh, well, I think I did that okay." As we came out, my boss said, he had a big smile all over his face, and he said, "That was very good. Do you know who those two people were?" So I said, "No, I didn't." So he said, "Well, the tall chap was Sir John Sainsbury, chairman of Sainsbury's, and the other guy was Peter Davis, who was the managing director of Sainsbury's." That stopped me in my tracks. But also the interesting thing was, is that if I had known beforehand who those two guys were, there's no way I would have said what I did. And what it taught me was, don't ever be intimidated by the position of somebody. You should actually just talk to people normally, which is what I've always done ever since. Oh, and Kellogg's take golden cups of corn and make their cornflakes the best you've ever bought. Oh, they are the ones that give your family. After 2 years in working in London for Kellogg's, they promoted me up to area manager, the first rung on the management ladder, which meant I had to move from London to Manchester. And for the first time, I had three people working for me. Two of the three people that were working for me were as old as my father. So that was quite a challenge, dealing with a couple of old gnarled sales reps. And the atmosphere in the company started to change, and supermarket chains were getting bigger and bigger. So sales forces were beginning to shrink. And I just thought, actually, this is my next move isn't going to go anywhere. The next company move was a role that was going to be made redundant within the next 2 or 3 years. So I thought, I don't really fancy doing that. Anyway, so listening to the radio all day long, which is what I used to do when I was out and about doing my various calls, but listening to Piccadilly Radio, which was just absolutely superb. One day I happened to hear an ad on the radio to go and join the local sales team at Piccadilly. And I thought, that sounds fantastic. So I wrote in to the sales director, a chap with a wonderful name of Bert Tatlock. And I remember walking into the office in Piccadilly Plaza in Manchester, and his first words to me were, "What on earth would you want to come and work for a radio station for when you've got a job like you've got at the moment?" Anyway, that's what took me. It took me aback slightly. Anyway, got on absolutely fine, and he offered me a job. And I joined the team. That was in 1979. There was only five of us in the team, I think. But Piccadilly was obviously the only commercial radio station in the market. It was the biggest station outside of London. It had been on air at this stage for about 5 years. I think it had an audience of something like 1.3 million listeners a week. It was absolutely enormous. It was, the station had a reach of about 39-40%. I couldn't believe it, going out there and selling advertising, a subject that I was really, really interested in, and persuading advertisers, not advertising the Manchester Evening News anymore, but to come and join us at Piccadilly Radio. If you're familiar with the centre of Manchester, it's changed a bit now, but Piccadilly Gardens, where the bus station was, there was a Woolworths on one side, Lewis's department store on the other side, Portland Hotel on the third side, and on the fourth side was this big glass and concrete monstrosity, the Sunley Building and Piccadilly Plaza, which was a fairly tacky shopping precinct. So you go up this escalator to Piccadilly Radio's reception. Martha and Pat were on reception at Piccadilly Radio for absolutely donkey's years. It was just a fabulous place to be. Terribly scruffy. The offices were full of cheap furniture, etc. But I think there was about 75, 80 people worked there. Fully staffed newsroom. There must have been 7 or 8 journalists.
13 centigrade, and that's 55 Fahrenheit. It's 5:30.
Piccadilly. First with news.
Two residents of Wisbech.
It wasn't that easy, because the biggest local advertisers in Manchester spent their money in newspapers. And also the amount of training that you got at Piccadilly Radio to go out and sell was zero compared to what I was used to at Kellogg's. I mean, I turned up and I was given a quarter of Manchester and handed a rate card, you know, a 2-page marketing pack and a map with lines drawn on it saying that's your territory. Get out and sell it. There wasn't much more to it than that. I scroll through the Manchester Evening News every day to see who was advertising in there, and you quickly worked out who the big advertisers were. I mean, I would get in the car and go out and just go and knock on doors, or I'd ring people up and say, can I come and see you? The fear of rejection quickly reduced, and, you know, because people were always, you wanted to talk about their local radio station, but actually then trying to persuade them to advertise on it was slightly different. Bert Tatlock, who used to spend an awful lot of his time in London, and the vast majority of the business coming into Piccadilly Radio was national advertising.
Help yourself to a better life with Woman's Realm. This week, a free sachet of Harmony Beautiful Body Shampoo to bring bounce and control.
You've got far more per spot out of the national market than you've got out of the local market. That reversed about a few years later. But also what actually helped at the time, ITV went on strike.
ITV technicians want a 25% rise or they'll strike.
All of a sudden, network, there was no outlet for television advertising, because ITV was the only game in town. There wasn't another TV broadcaster. For about 3 months, I think, not long after I joined, we couldn't really take any local advertising anyway, because it was actually full up with national advertising.
Welcome home to ITV.
Getting to know various different advertisers and just trying to get in to see them and get to know them and getting them to trust you and know that you would actually be giving them good advice takes a while. The biggest local advertiser in my patch was a furniture retailer called Tweedy's, the local distributor for Schreiber Furniture. But they would be on the front page of the Manchester Evening News at least once a week. They'd have a quarter page, and there's a broadsheet in those days. They must have been spending £65,000-£70,000 a year for a local advertiser. That was just absolutely enormous. And they were advertising in other local newspapers as well. And they weren't advertising on radio at all. So I used to go and see this guy every day I was in Stockport. I would go in and see them and just get to know the two brothers that ran the store. They were difficult guys to deal with, but gradually over a period of time, would get to know me and make me a cup of tea, and we'd have a chat, and still not interested in advertising at all. It was trust with him. He needed to have someone he could trust to deal with, because very often, if you're dealing with a direct advertiser, if you get to know them well, they would talk to you about all sorts of things, not just about advertising on the radio. They'd be talking about their business overall, and if they thought you were sensible, they would ask your advice on things. I thought, well, I'll just bide my time and just carried on talking, told them what we were doing on the station. They still weren't interested. And then literally one day, I got a phone call from Alan Tweedy for him to call me. Highly unusual. So I get a phone call from him, and the guy said, could you please get me a parking space at the Hotel Piccadilly car park, which is just above where the radio station was, because I want to come and see you in about an hour's time. And of course, he drove a Rolls Royce, and he was very proud of that, and he wanted everyone to know that he was driving it. Anyway, I went upstairs, slipped the concierge a couple of quid, saying there's the chap coming in with a roller, this is the registration, make sure he gets a nice place to park. He came in, and he clearly had a big fallout with the Manchester Evening News, and he said, I want to give the wireless a try. And he said, I want to go on this weekend. So literally put a package together, a couple of grand's worth of advertising, which was no mean deal in those days. I think we probably bonused him a few spots as well to make sure the thing was working as you did. Anyway, it went on that weekend because they used to do a lot of their business on a Sunday trading. Anyway, he did it. The campaign brought lots of people in. And he came back on again and again and again. Within a year, he was spending £60,000-£70,000 a year. I want you to be my girl. The lineup had been well established at Piccadilly, but a new guy came along called Mike Sweeney, who was had been lead singer in the Salford Jets. Oh, yeah. Anyway, Tony Ingham, I think it was Tony Ingham or Colin Waters, I can't remember which one actually made the decision, but they decided to put Sweeney on daytimes in the afternoons.
Gradually, as the years went by through the late 70s and early 80s, pulling in a range of much more talented, much more relevant people who may not have been DJs before.
And when he came on air, most people had never heard him before. I think he'd previously done a Sunday afternoon show. The telephones went absolutely potty. What seemed like hundreds of people calling up to complain about this loudmouth lout with a proper Mancunian accent, talking about stuff that he used to do in Manchester and the nightlife and all the various other things that he would get up to. But the interesting thing was that there was as many people who thought it was fantastic as there were who thought it was terrible. But the reaction was absolutely astonishing. He was a terrific presenter. But one of the side effects of that was a company called All Sports, which was a sports retailer in Manchester, had half a dozen shops in those days, run by a guy called David Hughes, who was a big advertiser in the Stockport Press, would never advertise on radio, actually hated radio, wouldn't even talk to me a lot of the time. All of a sudden, Sweeney comes on air, and after a few days, this guy called me up and said, come and talk to me. I love this Mike Sweeney. Signed him up and actually managed to persuade Mike Sweeney to do the voiceover for his commercials. And all of a sudden, because of a presenter, an advertiser who I'd had great trouble getting on air, suddenly became an advertiser because he liked the presenter. It was interesting seeing that kind of thing, that kind of reaction when something happened, when you did something big on air, how listeners would respond. It was just fantastic to see it. Yeah, because I think when you're selling a product like cornflakes or something, you don't really see it physically. Whereas with radio, you do something and you can see the reaction. If the business that you're talking to listen to the radio station, you're a long way down the track of getting them on air. If they didn't ever listen, you know, it was more difficult.
My guest today, you must have guessed, Les Gray. Unfortunately, forever, or not unfortunately, linked forever with mud, no matter what you do.
Can't get away.
I was at Piccadilly Radio. I was there from 1979 to 1981. In 1981, I got a phone call from an ITV company, LWT, one of 15 ITV contractors. And they were looking for a regional sales manager to run their Manchester operation, which was quite exciting. When I say the Manchester operation, it was everything north of London. And you know, the opportunity to go and work for one of the big TV contractors was too good an opportunity to pass up. In those days, LWT was the weekend contractor for London. So it was on air from 5.15 or 5.30 on a Friday through to close down on Sunday. So they were up against Thames Television. You had the rotten end of the schedule. The London market was the only market where there was a competitor for television advertising. So it was LWT or Thames. The sales director at LWT was a chap called Ron Miller, who's an absolute legend. A more charismatic character you couldn't wish to meet. Came up with lots of innovative ideas as to how to sell the weekend schedule. I spent the best part of 7 years there. We grew the business from about £1 million up to about £4 million over that time. And during that period, Channel 4 launched. and Channel 4, which was the, it's hard to believe this now, but that was the second commercial channel. The deal was that Channel 4 didn't employ its own sales force. ITV sold it for them. So we used to sell the Channel 4 schedule at the weekend for London at the same time as selling the ITV schedule. And that meant going out and talking to lots of advertisers and getting lots of new advertisers to advertise on television. Some of the entry cost into advertising on Channel 4 was much lower than ITV. Everything I'd learnt from selling at media at Piccadilly Radio and at Kellogg's before that all came into very good stead, and we'd go out and talk to lots of people who had never even thought about advertising on television or never thought they could afford it. All of a sudden, they could. So therefore, your portfolio just grew and grew and grew in terms of who you could actually go out and talk to, which was great. In 1988, Bert Tatlock had left Piccadilly Radio, and I got a call from Colin Walters to say, do you fancy coming back to Piccadilly Radio as sales director? And this was immediately prior to all the splits actually happening. So the FM-AM splits. Piccadilly Radio was a long way down the track of putting their plans into operation to launch Key 103. And also, Piccadilly had also recently floated. They bought other businesses as well. It had changed not a huge amount since I'd left 7 years before, but with a very exciting time ahead with Key 103 about to launch. And, you know, there was a few more radio stations around then. When I'd been back there in 79, 81, there was only 19 radio stations. And I think in 1988, that number had risen to about 35, 40, something like that. The launch happened at the beginning of September. They're taking the unusual decision of putting the new brand on FM and consigning Piccadilly to the AM service, which in hindsight was quite a big mistake.
Welcome to Key 103, the world's newest radio station, broadcasting to you exclusively.
But they launched it with a snazzy TV campaign with a strapline which I never understood, called music. Not music. It was a bit nonplussed by it. Lots of new presenters. It sounded quite good. And we just carried on as normal. We thought this was going to be an opportunity to expand, grow our audiences overall, make us even more competitive in the marketplace. And for a few months, that kept us very busy. But also, Piccadilly Radio was extremely keen to acquire because the ownership rules had been relaxed a little bit. Colin Walters, who was the chief exec at that time, had his eye on buying BRMB, or I think it was Central England Radio in those days, which was BRMB and Mercia. Talks got underway, I think, that autumn, and got a long way down the track, and the deal had, to all intents and purposes, been agreed. It sounded like it was going to be very, very exciting, but literally, I think it was in January 1989, literally the night before the deal was due to be completed, Owen Oyston, the owner of Red Rose and Radio Air, came in with a very, very high bid for Piccadilly Radio, which was conditional upon the BRMB deal being dropped, because I don't think he was allowed to own both Piccadilly and BRMB with the stations he already owned, which stopped everything in its tracks. And that was a period of massive disruption for obviously all the staff at Piccadilly, because everyone thought that was going to happen. And then Owen Oyston, who had a certain reputation in the northwest of England, came in with this bid, an incredible amount of money, and that then went through. But I remember going to all the various meetings, the shareholder meetings and the press conferences and all that kind of thing, when all these things were being discussed and questions were being asked. I couldn't believe what was actually going on, insofar as it just seemed to be an astonishing amount of money as to why they would pay that amount of money for the station. But that's what they did.
Key 103.
The update at 2 o'clock. I'm Joanna Hartley. It seems likely that Lancashire millionaire Owen Oyston's won his £39 million takeover bid for the Piccadilly Radio Group. His Miss World Group.
Owen got hold of a huge prize, the biggest station outside of London. A new management team came in, a chap called Julian Allitt and a guy called Michael Connolly, who was the finance director and the operations guy. And Owen made his presence very clearly felt in the radio station as well, which sort of stopped the plans that had previously been there, stopped them in their tracks, I guess. I fairly quickly decided I didn't really want to hang around too long. Owen was a character that the whole thing was incredibly disruptive. Whilst I got on with him perfectly well, I just didn't like the way he went about doing his business, quite frankly. He didn't treat people very nicely. He got rid of a lot of people at Piccadilly Radio in the most appalling way. I mean, I think we had to get rid of about 20 staff. And basically, letters were just left on people's desks. And if there's a letter on your desk, that was it, you're out of a job. No conversation ever took place. They just got rid of lots of people. I'll be sitting in my office in Manchester and get a phone call from Owen's secretary to say, Owen wants to see you at Euston in 3 hours. Get on the next train, go around and see him, and he wants to come back to Manchester with you to discuss things. And it was that kind of thing that would go on all the time. And he just had no respect for anybody else's time or the efforts they were putting in. Just something I didn't want to feel part of. The interesting thing was, though, literally, I think probably 3 or 4 weeks after the deal had been completed, the first RAJAR results, or JICRA results as they were then, came out, which showed what our audience was doing since the split. It was a disaster. The combined station, Piccadilly and Key 103, had lost over 30% of its audience in one survey. And the FM audience was tiny, which had a absolutely dramatic effect on revenue. Our sales house made it absolutely clear what the financial impact was going to be, and I had the unpleasant task of sitting down and talking to Owen to say, do you realise now that we're going to lose probably 25% of our revenue overnight? Which obviously decreased the value of what he had bought just recently. Anyway, he couldn't get his head around it at all. He didn't understand how that could possibly be the case. I started looking around for something else to do because I didn't really want to hang around. At that time, this is in 1989, the TV sales houses were starting to come into being rather than the ITV companies all selling themselves. And one of my old bosses from LWT left to go to Yorkshire Television as sales director. So I had a chat with him and he wanted to set up a radio sales business in London. After a couple of chats with him, decided that's what I was going to do. So I handed in my notice at Piccadilly and moved back down to London to set up the radio arm of a media and airtime sales, which launched in early 1990. The risk side of it, I just thought, well, I've got nothing to lose, actually. It's just, I don't want to be where I am. The overriding emotion was excitement rather than fear. Yeah, things were expanding. There were lots of new opportunities coming up. The Radio Authority had just recently licensed 23 new licenses. So the opportunity of launching a new radio sales house as a competitor to the two others that were around seemed to be quite good. One of them was Air Services, and the other one was called BMS. They actually had the national sales contracts between them for every single radio station in the country. So they dealt with all the advertising agency business, all the national advertisers for every radio station. When these new radio licenses came up, people assumed that these new licenses were going to be in markets that the two existing sales houses already had stations, and that would present a conflict, possibly. Because I think it was very much in the context these days of each radio station had its own market and it didn't have a competitor. It didn't have another radio station competitor in everywhere bar London. These new upstarts coming along, was a potential threat to them. So anyway, we decided to set this business up. What we hadn't counted on was the fact that we were heading straight into an advertising recession. It was an extremely lousy time to launch a business. But we went out and pitched for the national sales for these new stations. And the first contract we picked up was Jazz FM.
Well, it certainly is very early in the morning, and I haven't got the blues because we are a brand new start.
That was, a real baptism of fire, because we're going out and trying to drum up interest for a format that had never been tried before. It was a bit of a challenge, to say the least. One of my best memories, I think, from that time was the launch party of Jazz FM. Was probably the best launch party I've ever been to. It was at the Grosvenor House Hotel, the great room. Not bad for a fledgling radio station. and the entertainment was Ella Fitzgerald and the Count Basie Orchestra.
It's the wrong time and wrong place.
From then on, things got pretty tough.
It's the wrong face.
We also got involved with selling for a number of other radio stations as well, brands that are not around anymore. Buzz FM, which was the Birmingham station, Sunset Radio in Manchester, which was run by Mike Shaft, who was ex-Piccadilly radio presenter. But then there was also some absolute silly stations that you think, why on earth would you want to launch this? Airport Information Radio, which served Gatwick and Heathrow. Trying to raise revenue for that was quite a challenge. But probably the most exciting part at that time actually was a radio station called Atlantic 252, which had launched at the back end of 1989. It was a long-wave radio station for Ireland, but it had a massive signal across virtually the whole of the UK, in fact, everywhere but London and the South East.
This is Atlantic 252. To improve your reception of our signal on the long-wave band, you could simply try lifting your radio set and turning it around a little bit to either the left or the right. Regular broadcasts of Atlantic 252 will begin soon.
And it was jointly owned by RTE and Radio Luxembourg. They had launched the back end of 1989 with a huge amount of protest from the UK commercial radio industry. There was a question over its legality, about how it could possibly not be a UK licensed broadcaster and still be able to broadcast to the UK. And they came to us. But again, it was still not easy because the station wasn't being measured in by JICRA. And it was absolutely being frozen out of everything to do with commercial radio because of the owners of existing UK commercial radio stations didn't want it around.
Atlantic 252, another nasty day of rock and roll coming to an end. Remember now, tonight, while we're no longer burning up the airwaves, you burn up the telephone lines and tell all of your friends long wave is the place to be. 252, starting at 6 a.m. until...
The station had some terrific presenters. It was aimed at a young audience, so the under 35s. It had just had tremendous energy. It was like a pirate in terms of the way it actually positioned itself.
Good
night. You know, it was a maverick. It was the reaction you were getting from listeners who had heard it. They thought it was just fantastic. Presenters like Charlie Wolf, Henry Owens, they were just great DJs.
6 minutes to news time. I'm Henry Owens, playing more in a row. Atlantic 252.
And the music was good. It was very, very tight. All of the dipstick research that was done by the station indicated that the audience was very significant. But of course, we couldn't measure it. What we decided to do was to try and get the radio industry to allow Atlantic 252 to be measured in JICRA. The UK commercial radio industry just would not allow Atlantic 252 in. So what we decided to do was to go out and commission audience research using exactly the same methodology as JICRA and producing a book in exactly the same format as the commercial radio industry, which we did. There was hundreds and hundreds of thousands, if not over a million listeners tuning into this radio station. One of the tasks that I had was to go out and talk to media directors of the big London agencies to say, you know, this is what we're doing. The UK radio industry won't let us in, but this is this radio station that you've never heard of, but this is what it's actually doing. And I remember going and talking to Ken New, who was the media director of Abbott Mead Vickers, who was a good friend of mine, and Richard Eyre, about the injustice of Atlantic 252 not being included. And they started to put pressure to actually get it changed. And things did start to change. And I think they started to improve the favourability towards the station very, very significantly. When Radar was formed for the first time, both the BBC and the commercial radio sector was measured at the same time using the same methodology. Atlantic 252 was eventually included in that.
The battle for control of London Weekend Television, one of ITV's most powerful companies, has ended in victory for Granada, makers of Coronation Street.
1993, the ITV mergers started to happen. For the first time, different ITV companies could merge with each other. LWT and I think it was Granada had come together and they put in a bid for Yorkshire Television. And when they actually completed that deal, they had no desire to be in the other media business. So we actually had to close that down in the middle of 1993. But that left me then without a job. and started doing some consultancy work for various people that I had come across as we were building up our radio sales house business. And one of the things that I actually did, the third commercial national license was coming up for grabs at that time. So I actually started putting a bid together for INR3, as it was called. And we submitted a bid for the consortium. It was called First National Entertainment Radio. It was a speech format. I learned an awful lot, probably made quite a lot of mistakes along the way. Although at the end of the day, when the bids went in, these bids were on a cash basis. You had to put some cash with your bid. We were not first. At the same time as the INR3 bid had been completed, a number of regional licences were being awarded by the Radio Authority. Chrysalis was successful in getting the licence for the West Midlands. Chrysalis had started its life as a music company in the 70s and expanded its business during the 80s into all kinds of other things. Richard Huntingford was the corporate development director at the time for Chrysalis, and their toe in the water had been with Metro Radio Group. They took a 20% stake. I think, as he would explain, that was, you know, so that they could actually learn about the business of radio. And Metro Radio was a fantastic company. Richard went out and hired Phil Riley, who had been at Radio Air for a couple of years and had originally been from BRMB. Phil then obviously started to set up his management team, gave me a call to see if I'd be interested in going to Heart as sales director. In fact, I was in the process of getting married at the time. I was away. Karen and I decided to finally tie the knot, and we were away in Jamaica, which is where we got married. And my father-in-law was actually staying in our house. I told George, my father-in-law, that I did not want to be disturbed under any circumstances, so don't tell me anything. Anyway, we were away for a couple of weeks, and when we got back, George was telling me that there was this rather persistent chap keeps ringing and wants to talk to you, and could you please give him a call as soon as you get back? So anyway, I did. He told me what was going on and said, I'd like to have a chat with you. I went in and had dinner with Richard and Phil. And I remember going out the door, and I thought, I've got to give this a go. I joined up with the team as it was beginning to grow.
You're listening to Test Transmissions from Heart FM, the new soft rock station for Warwickshire and the West Midlands, due to start broadcasting at 7 a.m. on September the 6th.
That was really, really exciting. Got hold of some premises on Broad Street in Birmingham, and I then had to start going out and recruiting a sales force, but also deciding what we were going to do in terms of how we were going to raise revenue for this brand new radio station, how would we go about it. That opportunity of having 3 or 4 months to hire a sales force and launch a radio station with literally a blank sheet of paper was incredibly exciting. Phil was terrific to work with, you know, insofar as he would let you get on with it to a very large extent. Yes, he often wanted to get his own way with things, but we used to have some fairly robust conversations about various things. But once you'd had the conversation, that was it. You just got on and did what you had agreed. But the exciting thing about it was, for the first time in UK commercial radio, here were some new licences that were genuinely going to compete with existing competition. The likes of Heart and Century, etc., were going to directly compete with their commercial radio competitors. But we were up against some very, very doughty competitors, because BRMB and Beacon and Mercia had been around for a long, long time and were extremely good operators. But they didn't know how to deal with competition. So eventually we started to work out, so what are we going to do? How are we going to go about this? I decided that maybe one of the things I should do is actually go and talk to some advertisers in Birmingham. I found out who the biggest advertisers were on BRMB. Started calling them up. Getting in to see people was relatively easy. People were interested to find out what was going on. But there was also, underlying that, a history of failures of other commercial radio stations. There was a good deal of scepticism that this wasn't going to work either. Anyway, the first person I ever went to see to talk about Heart, the first advertiser, was a guy called Horace Brisbane, dealer principal for Renault in Birmingham. Big advertiser on BRMB, spent an absolute fortune. He was a lovely fella. I went down and sat and talked to him. Although what you do with most of these car dealers is they talk to you rather than you talk to them. You just ask the odd question here and there and they'll tell you their life stories. But I went out to try and find out why they advertised on BRMB, what kind of results they actually got, what they liked about the radio station, what they didn't like about the radio station, He didn't like the fact that there was so many ads. He didn't like the idea that sometimes his ad appeared in the same ad break as another car retailer, whinges and moans, etc. That was a very, very useful meeting. I then had three or four more with major advertisers in the market. From that, we started to formulate this idea, restricting the number of ads that we played. Also doing things like category exclusivity, three ads in a break, and having no more than 12 ads in an hour. Incentivized people to use longer commercials. But also another thing was accountability. People were a bit nonplussed about whether the ads that they had bought, whether they actually got them. Because the transmission certificates that were being sent out or the stuff that was going out with invoices, in actual fact, weren't transmission certificates. They were campaign plans. We went back to talk to these advertisers, and Horace Brisbane was the first one I went back to say, and we've got a launch plan as well for the first 12 advertisers that sign up with the radio station. If you give me £10,000, you get one of the first hours of the first 12 hours. You'll be the only advertiser in that hour. And he said, yes, straight away. He thought, blimey.
Toyota, IKEA, Swinton, Renault, Maryhill. Just some of the businesses who'll be advertising on 100.7 Heart FM. We'll be broadcasting from...
One of the greatest compliments was BRMB, who started calling up these advertisers that were appearing on Heart, saying, what on earth are you doing spending our money on that radio station? So the station launched. We've got some great feedback from advertisers and listeners alike. We had an electronic billboard down at the NEC, which actually now playing strip going across the bottom of a 48-sheet poster. And literally about 7 or 8 weeks after launch, some new licences for London were being awarded as well. And Chrysalis had actually put in an application and they were successful. We won the licence for London. It was just a feeling of absolute elation. This was a very, very big moment in, well, as it proved, into both my career and Phil's career and all the team that were involved with the radio station overall. This could actually turn Chrysalis into a serious competitor in the marketplace. The name had not been decided at that point. The licence application name was for Crystal FM. And Keith was very, very keen on not using Heart in London because he felt that the name was too soft and it wouldn't convey what we wanted to convey on air. Anyway, there were long debates held about what it was going to be called. Phil felt very strongly that it should be Heart. And certainly I did as well. There were no brands other than Capital Radio at that time. Every single radio station around the country was a separate brand, and here was an opportunity to actually start to create something. Capital Radio was also one single license, but it was well established and it was in London and everybody knew about it, and that was, you know, it was treated very, very seriously. Thank God it was you know, that argument was won and it was decided that Heart was going to be the name for the radio station in London. Again, it's one of those big moments. If it hadn't been done, who knows what would have happened. One year less a day, the station launched in London, September the 5th, 1995. It launched in a blaze of publicity. But I do remember the launch of Heart London. We had a launch party the night before. The launch party was for advertisers and agency people, and it was at Air Studios, fantastic place to hold a party. Connection there was George Martin, who was a board director and chairman of Heart London.
The solid core of people, I don't really get everything concentrated for them, which is what we're doing. We're aiming at the 25-year to 45-year-old people.
George Martin is probably one of the most important figures in popular music, I think, ever. And he was an absolute grand gentleman, an absolute delight to deal with and spend time with. But I do remember going back to the hotel, the Holiday Inn, I think it was, in Shepherd's Bush that night, for a couple of nightcaps with a few of the people that we'd invited and also a number of the staff. Partying till very, very late, and I think I went to bed sometime around 4 o'clock. My last sight before I went to bed was that John Davis, who was due to be reading the first news bulletin, was holding forth in the bar, almost incoherent. And I thought, thank God I'm not the programme director, because he's got to read the first news bulletin at 7:20. The station was due to be on air from 7 o'clock. Anyway, I rolled up at the radio station at about 7:15, waiting for everything to start and dreading what was going to happen at 20 past. Anyway, everything launched, everyone was very happy. and we get to the first news bulletin at 7:20. John Davis at the mic read the news. Word perfect.
7:05. There are bags of people around the studio. It's chaos here. This is Gloria Estefan. It's too late on the new, the brand new Heart 106.2.
Stayed in bed all morning just to pass the time.
Radio was growing in popularity. These new stations that were coming along were popular, expanding the commercial radio audience. In general, selling advertising was getting slightly easier, and there's a greater degree of acceptability about it.
It's too late, baby, now it's too late.
Again, a couple of months after we launched Heart London, our first acquisition came along. We had the opportunity to buy Galaxy, based in Bristol, which was one of the other regional licences. Obviously a completely different format. Galaxy was quite similar to KISS in many ways, aimed at a young under 35 audience. Had it previously been a pirate in Bristol, I think it was called FTP, which then became Galaxy Radio, and they had then won the regional licence. And it was owned at that time by Chiltern Radio. It was up for sale, and we paid, I think, about £4 million for it in 1995. And I was going to be responsible for sales for that radio station as well. This was a radio station that had been run on a shoestring. It was run out of a really, really grotty building on the edge of St. Paul's in Bristol. There was a wonderful spirit amongst the staff. They were very excited to be involved with the radio station, but they didn't have the tools to do the job. The studios had been built for the cheapest possible cost. The reputation in the local market wasn't very good. They weren't getting very much money for the advertising that they were selling. So there was a huge challenge in every single respect there. GWR were the main radio station in Bristol, and GWR was just enormous. And they were wiping the floor with Galaxy. I heard a story from one advertiser saying, there's three things you can buy in Portland Square for a tenner. A spliff, a shag, or a campaign on Galaxy 101.
Galaxy 101.
I remember going into the studio, just having a chat with one of the DJs who was on air. And I was looking at what was going on the screen with ad breaks, etc. And I noticed there were a lot of ads that hadn't been ticked. I wanted to know why. What was he doing with the system? He said, "Oh, those are ads that we're supposed to play, but we haven't got any copy for, so they don't actually get played at all." And it was just like, "Well, that's normal. You know, it happens." Oh God, we've got so much work to do here. And it did grow from strength to strength. But I would say, out of all the stations that Chrysalis owned over a 13-year period, Galaxy 101 was the most difficult. In 1997, the opportunity came up to buy two radio stations in Manchester and Yorkshire, which were licensed as KISS stations. So they were independently owned, but had been licensed by EMAP to use the KISS brand. Two big stations covering Manchester and the whole of Yorkshire, about a 4 million market. We went in, and again, these radio stations were relatively new, hadn't exactly had an awful lot of investment put into them, but they were running on adrenaline and enthusiasm and a very willing and able sales team trying to go out there and generate revenues, and a programming team that were, well, the daytime shows were okay, but at night there was a number of specialist shows from club DJs, etc., that were very popular but very difficult to raise money for. And in fact, I think in Manchester, when we first got there, the evening DJs were actually had arrangements with the owners that they could actually keep the revenue that was generated on their own shows, which was slightly unusual. When the change of ownership actually happened, it was something that EMAP hadn't really foreseen. They had been quite happy to license it out to the previous owners. And when Chrysalis came along, their view changed somewhat. And the meeting between Tim Schoonmaker, who was running EMAP at the time, and Richard Huntingford to discuss the brand licensing agreement that we had inherited. I remember very clearly that he turned up for this meeting. Tim Schoonmaker was a guy who had his own inimitable style, quite a tough negotiator. Anyway, he turned up and they discussed what we wanted to do, etc., and how we can continue the agreement. And Tim Schoonmaker said, "You've got 7 days, and that's it. You can't have it any more than 7 days." So I think the entire brand had to be taken away and launched a new one in 7 days, which was pretty tough. But that's what he did. Banged his book down, walked out the door. That was it. End of story. And I think I'm right in saying Steve Parkinson was given that responsibility of getting all the marketing sorted out and rebranded, etc. But literally, I can't remember whether we actually managed to negotiate a bit of an extension to the 7 days, but that was the marker that was laid down a couple of weeks later. Two radio stations, previously trading under one brand name, were changed from scratch to Galaxy.
Locked in to the brand new Galaxy 102 and 105.
At this point, we've got five radio stations. We're number three in the market, in the UK market overall. So we're still not big enough by any stretch of the imagination. Galaxy, generally, generating local revenues was always quite a challenge. The thing that we always are battling against in the local marketplace was your audience is very young. Young people don't come and buy what we're selling. That was the thing that was levelled at us all the time, and always exacerbated by our ILR competitors as well. In the national marketplace, it was rather different. Advertisers were searching out for media opportunities that were delivering a young audience sufficiently, and Galaxy was starting to build some real scale. You know, you go out and talk to advertisers or advertising agencies. You know, you've got KISS in London, which is a big player. Well, the Galaxy radio stations outside of London have got a similar audience profile to KISS. The national revenue was easier to build than the local revenue was, in actual fact, because of that. Knowing that there was a presenter and a programme director who saw advertising promotions as part of the programming mix rather than an irritation in the programming mix made the job a damn sight easier. There were programmers who were extremely good, and there were some that were just damn awkward. And there were presenters who were fantastic. Toby Anstice was my all-time favourite. Extremely good. One great example was when he was on Heart London, one of the agencies that we were dealing with, one of the biggest agencies, Mediacom, were not particularly good on radio. They had some fantastic brands, but they were massively under-investing in radio. And someone in our trade marketing department actually came up with this idea. Maybe we could actually ask Mediacom if we could actually set up a radio station within the advertising agency itself. Anyway, we asked Toby to come and do it. He willingly spent the entire afternoon at Mediacom, got all the engineers to set up all the kit, broadcasting via their network. This place was employing 400 or 500 people. Heart for Mediacom for a whole afternoon. Toby Anstice sat there, did a full show, in addition to his own daytime show, stayed for the evening and hosted a drinks party with everybody as well. And we did an enormous amount of business out of that. In fact, we did business the same afternoon.
So it's Tuesday morning. How you doing? This is Tobe. A whole heap of songs here you're going to enjoy. No interruptions while we get on things like Blondie, The Tide Is High, Alex...
In the 2000s, it got to a point, I think, when the major players were Capital Radio Group, the GWR Group, and EMAP, and ourselves, Chrysalis. We were the smaller ones of the major groups. And I think as time progressed through that decade, the dot-com boom had taken place. Revenue was becoming increasingly under threat. Audiences weren't growing particularly well in commercial radio at that time. And commercial radio stations, with a lack of restrictions on how much minutage you could actually run, had actually increased the amount of minutage by an enormous amount, and audiences were starting to go backwards. It wasn't the sole reason, but that was what was actually happening. Something was bound to happen at some point, and I think it was in 2005, GWR and GCAP announced a merger, which was huge. It obviously was going to create this massive group of about 70-odd radio stations, and that created a massive group with very little fallout. What also happened then is that everyone started to take on their own sales as well. So the likes of the major sales houses had gone away. Basically, everyone was handling their own business. There were one or two exceptions to that. For instance, Chrysalis handled the GMG radio business with their real brand. And once you get one acquisition going on, you know, in the GWR GCAP instance, that was a huge shift. You've got basically number one and number two merging together, therefore putting some fair distance between themselves and EMAP. And you think, well, what's going to happen next? And I think Chrysalis, for a long time, had danced around the possibility of trying to take over GMG, and I think GMG had danced around the idea of buying Chrysalis. But having got to the point where we couldn't get a deal done with GMG, GMG couldn't get a deal done with us, you think with all this consolidation taking place, if we just stay at number three in the marketplace, number three is never a good place to be. You're not going to dominate anything. You're not going to control anything. You need to be number one or at best number two. Chrysalis Radio was on the block, and eventually a deal was completed in July 2007. And we had presented to numerous people. Eventually a bid came in from a company called Global Radio, which nobody had heard of before because it hadn't existed before. And a deal was agreed, I think, for $170 million to sell it to them. And it took the market by surprise. People didn't know who they were. It was Ashley Tabor and Richard Park had acquired their new baby. So that was a very big and dramatic time at the end of July. I worked for Chrysalis for 13 years from the beginning to the end, and it was the most exciting time to build a business from scratch up to something very significant. You felt a tremendous amount of pride, and the management team had largely remained unchanged. I mean, Phil Riley and myself had worked together for all of that 13 years, and a number of other people as well had been there throughout that 13-year period. But the frustration was we could never expand the business as fast as we wanted to. I mean, we've missed out on buying Melody Radio. We've missed out on a couple of other acquisition opportunities because we couldn't actually raise the funds to do it, or it would diluted Chris Wright's shareholding to such an extent to not make it worthwhile. And that was the frustration. So something had to happen. From my perspective, being bought by somebody else was the inevitable consequence of all of that. But who was going to buy it, we just didn't know. When we found out who it was and got to know them a little bit, from my perspective, I thought, well, actually, this is really, really exciting because these guys seem to have access to virtually unlimited funds, and they want to do other things, and they want to play a major part in the consolidation of the industry. The sad side of it is that it has actually broke up virtually the entire Chrysalis management team over the following couple of months, because obviously the new owners wanted to do things their way and change an awful lot of things and take costs out of the business. And there was a few weeks of very, very tough stuff going on with station managing directors and various other people leaving the business. But you know, once that was all done, I think I was virtually the only director of the old Chrysalis Radio that actually stayed with the business. Probably because, well, it was Ashley and Richard were both from, obviously, a programming background, and Charles Allen was the chairman, but also, albeit a non-exec chairman. Charles was responsible for knocking ITV into shape and did a fantastic job. Didn't make him popular, but he did a fantastic job. They didn't have anybody in that team that had commercial expertise. I guess they wanted to have somebody that actually knew the ropes and knew the business inside out as well. They made me chief operating officer after that. And, you know, I decided, well, I'll stay with it and see how it goes. Because I stayed with it for another 2 years. I'd say that 2 years, well, I'd probably worked the hardest I've ever worked in my life. And I was probably the most stressful as well. But also I learned an awful lot in that time as well. Because immediately after, not only did we have the financial markets crash not long after that deal was completed, but literally within the space of a few weeks, Global Radio put in a bid for EMAP. And that went on for a few weeks. And that bid was actually unsuccessful. And this is where Bauer came in. Bauer actually bought it. And that completed at the end of November, beginning of December. That was a big disappointment that the first acquisition target didn't actually work. But having said that, the following day, a letter went into GCAP making an offer for that business. So I thought, blimey, they don't want to mess about, these guys. And over the next 3 months, that whole thing played out. That bid was eventually successful. 375 million quid later, the old Chrysalis Radio, or Global Radio, as it was then, acquired GCAP Media. That was David eating Goliath. It was challenging. It was very challenging because they were completely different people. Having worked, I guess, in many ways, Chrysalis Radio was a bit like a warm bath. You know, everybody knew each other very well. There weren't too many personality clashes. Everyone got on very well. There was a terrific collaborative spirit. When you get a completely new culture coming in, that is a massive challenge. It's a massive challenge to anybody for a long-established business. You know, Richard Park, a very combative character, quite a difficult man to deal with at times. But Ashley coming in, who I got to know very well, was a young guy who had at that point little or no experience of managing a fairly substantial business. He was only 29 years old, but he was younger than my son. That was quite strange. But he and I got on very well. I really liked him. He was a good guy. He picked things up incredibly quickly. I remember Charles Allen saying once that when I first met Ashley, he didn't know what EBITDA was, but now he can calculate it. but he did that in a complimentary way, insofar as he just picked things up incredibly quickly. I mean, he worked his socks off. Yeah, he asked people to do things that people didn't want to do at times, but he wanted to get things done his way. He had big ideas, and he wanted to get things done incredibly quickly.
Over 40% of radio listening in the UK is to commercial stations. The sector has been consolidating fast and is now dominated by large groups, including Guardian Media Group, that runs Smooth Radio, UTV, yes, that's Ulster Television in Northern Ireland, and Global Radio, that has Capital Heart and Classic FM. Now, those three have been...
Global Radio, in two acquisitions, became the largest player by a long, long way. I think whilst they have probably not been the most collaborative in terms of working with the other companies, and they were less supportive of the trade bodies because they wanted to plough their own furrow, the fact is that they have been hugely successful in merging together all the radio stations that they acquired into massively successful brands. And the proposition of what they have to offer to the advertising marketplace now is far stronger than could be have envisaged under a multiplicity of ownership of lots of different groups. Because their vision of taking on all those extra stations and turning them into Heart and to Capital. Okay, there's an awful lot of people have lost their jobs along the way. But as a proposition for the medium, it has been incredibly strong. And I think they have been a force for good, although they've not made themselves the most popular amongst their trade counterparts.
Now, exclusive details of another big shake-up in commercial radio. Britain's biggest radio group, home to Johnny Vaughan, is to rebrand almost a dozen of its ILR music stations to create a national rival to BBC Radio 1. Sky's business correspondent, Darshini David, joined...
At the end of it, I was absolutely exhausted. And to some extent, it came to a natural conclusion for me. I felt I'd done enough and it was time to do something else. And that's the way it was. So in 2009... decided that was the end of that. Sat down with Stephen Myron and cracked out a deal, and away I went. I felt that I'd done everything I needed to do. It was time to do something else. Within the 5 or 6 years following that, I did lots of different consultancy work, quite a large range of companies. But I worked mostly with Celador. Paul Smith was the founder of Celador TV production company, most famous for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, was desperate to get into the radio business and had tried for 20-odd years to get a licence and had finally got one with the regional licence down in the Solent. So I worked with him for 5 years on building up his portfolio of interests and also, you know, knocking the businesses into shape. So I worked with Paul on that, initially in a non-exec capacity, but it ended up when there was more and more acquisitions coming aboard, running the business for a while. Other things that I did was I worked with the owners on Channel Television, who served the Channel Islands, who were very interested in buying the two radio licences over there. That didn't actually come to anything in the end. Worked with TalkSport for quite a few months on reorganising their commercial operations, and various other pieces of work for other media owners, whether they were getting in or getting out of the radio business. I've enjoyed every single job that I've done. There's always been good bits and bad bits, but I count myself incredibly fortunate to have worked in this business, although it sometimes feels like a bit of a fraud, because if I go back to my family from the beginning, is that, you know, being one of six children, having had a very religious upbringing, I had a brother who was a vicar all of his life, another brother who was a school teacher and became a headmaster of a school, and my two sisters were both in the nursing profession. They all had proper, worthy jobs, and I ended up flogging spots for a living.
Don Thompson. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast. I'm David Lloyd. Catch my book, Two Radio Moments, looking back through my own eyes, a very candid look back at the last 50 years in radio. It's called Radio Moments.